Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, our theme is the water crisis in California and around the world. We will interview investigative reporters Catherine Mizkowski and Lance Williams on water usage in California. We'll also hear from spoken word artist Nick George, who has some things for us to think about on water. Also, San Francisco State University Project Censored researcher Stephen Ferrer joins us to talk about problems of hydraulic fracturing and water contamination. And finally, we'll hear from author Kirk Hyland, author of If the Earth Could Speak, about possible solutions for our current water woes. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, our theme is water crisis in California and around the world. We have numerous guests talking about the challenges we face on water, particularly in the state of California. And here is my co-host, Peter Phillips, to introduce our first guests. Peter?
We have two reporters from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Our first is Catherine Mizkowski. A reporter for Reveal, and she covers the environment, focusing on food and water. She's also a senior writer for Salon, Fast Company, and The Bay Citizen. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, and Ms. Welcome. Thank you, Catherine.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great. Also with her is Lance Williams. He's a senior reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. His reports focus on money and politics. He's twice won Journalism's George Polk Award for medical reporting while at the Center for Investigative Reporting, for coverage of the Balco sports steroid scandal while at the San Francisco Chronicle. Lance, thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you. Now, you both co-authored an article on water in California. We all know that there's a drought in California. Certainly, we've been seeing PSAs on television telling us to take short showers. And the governor is telling people that they're going to have mandated controls. But you have both written an article saying why California won't identify who's really draining the state's groundwater. Can you tell us about that? Catherine, let's start with you.
Sure. So we are in this extraordinary drought, but California has some laws that prevent our citizens from finding out who's actually using the largest amounts of water. That's both in a residential context, companies, and now with our new groundwater law that we passed last year. This was hailed as, you know, the first time that California was really going to regulate groundwater. Groundwater is an extremely important source of water for agriculture. As most of you probably know, agriculture uses the vast majority of water used by humans in California. And during droughts, they use even more of it. And so last year, the state finally decided we were going to impose some controls on pumping of the groundwater and wells. But in doing so, we enshrined secrecy into that law. We basically said, yes, the amount that's being pumped will have to be reported, but we won't be able to find out, you know, who's doing it.
So, Lance, could you add to that? Or,
well, the issue is not public shaming of people. It's really to reveal to the rest of the state whether conservation measures are actually getting any traction. If you can't find out, well, we have rules about how much groundwater you can take, how much now in your residential community, how much you can pump without penalty. But if we can't find out if that's actually taking hold, there's no confidence in the conservation programs. That's why we think this is perhaps wrong-headed to conceal this information from the public.
So what you're saying is that the farmers, and it could be almonds, tomatoes, dairy, sugar beets, whatever, in the Central Valley, who are pumping water from the ground to irrigate these crops, are not reporting that, or they're supposed to be reporting it. And we just recently read that most have not made that declaration. And this has been lowering the water table, lowering the land. And it was 100 years ago where this vast sea of water underneath the Central Valley was kind of identified, and rural electrification happened in 1915. And Southern Pacific and University of California, Davis sent a train around to convince all the farmers that they could pump all the water they wanted from this land, and they've been doing so for 100 years. That's not working well. It's not an unlimited resource. So what's going on with reporting on this?
Well, the state finally is going to regulate how much water you can take from the aquifers. There'll be limits put in place years from now. But if you want to find out who's draining the aquifer, who's taken too much, if you want any data on that, you can't get it. A state law, an amendment to the state's Public Records Act, was applied to this measure, and it puts that information off limits. You can't get it.
Well, Catherine, explain how exactly this changed. I mean, because you go back and you write about the 1990s, right? So give us the history of this, because it used to be a public records request, but now because of, you cite security concerns and these other things. So there are actual reasons, right, why. It's not just some corrupt issue where people are trying to conceal water use per se. I mean, I'm sure that's an argument floating around.
Well, what happened, it used to be that residential urban water usage was a matter of public record. So during the last drought, like back in 1991, newspapers would write stories, like the Los Angeles Times wrote a story saying, here are the top 100 water users in San Diego. And guess what? Helen Copley, who was then the publisher of the San Diego Union Tribune, is using 10,000 gallons of water a day at her, you know, 9.5-acre estate where she has 10 full-time gardeners. And there would be, you know, public outcry because meanwhile people are being asked to, you know, take shorter showers and not flush their toilet after they go pee or whatever, right? So that was the case in the early 90s. But then in 1997, the city of Palo Alto, which has both a water utility and an electric energy utility, they got concerned. They said, oh, you know, we have a lot of very prominent tech executives living in our area. And what if somebody was to find out their water usage or their address? And so the city of Palo Alto got the state legislature to pass a law amending the California Public Records Act, which is our most important public records law, and essentially weakening it and making not only those addresses and phone numbers secret for residential utility customers, but their actual usage. So now it's enshrined in state law that that usage is private. And, you know, back in the earlier drought, the Oakland Tribune wrote a story that, you know, identified the top 100 water customers in the East Bay. And after that happened, there was large public outcry and public policy was actually changed. And so, as Lance said, it's not just a question of like public shaming or, you know, kind of making fun of the largest water users. But when these large water users have been exposed in the past, that has actually led to policy change. But we don't have that now.
No, and that's an incredible problem. We want to get to more of that. The problem, seriously, is a lack of transparency, right? I mean, the Public Records Act is supposed to provide that. But I was sort of teasing up a little bit ago. There was actually an incident of violence that was attributed to this, right? And you write about this, where an actress was stalked, right? Lance, do you want to?
Sure.
I mean, this is the cover for the story. I mean, this is a possibly legitimate concern, but now we have lack of transparency as another real problem.
Well, state agencies routinely redact private information from public records requests. And the actress who was killed in 1989 because a private eye got her address from the DMV and gave it to a stalker, okay, don't give out people's home addresses. But that doesn't mean don't give out the critically important information for public policy decisions.
So who's behind, in your estimation, Lance and then Catherine, who's behind this this shielding then? How did this happen, and where is the outcry about it?
Well, as Catherine pointed out, it started with the city of Palo Alto wanting to protect tech executives' privacy. But I think the water agencies aren't comfortable with revealing their customers' water use I don't think they're comfortable with enforcing conservation rules, actually, and it's all part of the same package.
Yeah, I think these water agencies are used to thinking of their customers as customers who they service, and that if you pay the money, you can basically have as much water as you want. And so it's a big change for these agencies to suddenly have to be telling people, oh, you should be using less and you're not watering, you know, on this many days a week, and that they're supposed to enforce rules and impose fines. And so the culture of these agencies is not that they would want to expose their largest customers in the press or, you know, possibly to some kind of public scorn.
So you both wrote an article called California Water Officials Aren't Following Their Own Call for Conservation. And so you were able to identify water usage for some individuals, I guess from city records and other things. Lance, can you tell us about this article?
Sure. The Public Records Act does make the water bills of officials who set water rates a matter of public access, and we did get 25 water districts' bills of their officials and went around the state and found some guys not conserving at all, even as they were beating on their customers to be more responsible. We had three officials who were using 1 million gallons a year. Is that 8 or 9 times what an average household uses?
Well, let's give some names here. Who are these people?
Well, the poster child for excessive water use was a guy called Mike Subaru. He's a city councilman in Riverside. He lives on a lovely home on a windswept desert hilltop that he's reconfigured so it looks like Tara in Gone with the Wind. Perhaps that's an exaggeration, but he does have a big willow tree and about an acre of grounds, and he was running the sprinklers 7 nights a week to rack up that million-gallon figure, and he just didn't see how he could conserve.
In fact, Mike Subaru said, according to the article that you did at revealnews.org, this is a quote from him, saying, do I have to sell my house to set that example, or do I have to just abolish all my shrubs? I don't know what to do. I don't know how I can reduce my water rate. That's an interesting glimpse into the mind of this class, really. It's not just this person. It's really a class issue in some ways. No, Catherine?
I mean, I think that's right, because about half of people's typical water use is outside, and the easiest thing to change in your water use is the water you use on your landscaping. And so when we looked at these people who were using extraordinary amounts of water, the typical reason would be they had very large properties or they had a lot of very thirsty landscaping. And so, you know, in one case, we had a guy who said, well, you know, my son's water polo team is in our pool all the time. And, you know, another guy told us that he had to take drastic measures and lock down his watering system from his gardener because the gardener, of course, wanted to make the lawn look really great. And here he was, you know, trying to conserve water. So, I mean, I do think that there's some correlation between, you know, higher affluence and people using these tremendous amounts of water.
I'd like to remind everyone you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. The topic today is water and the water crisis and challenges that we're facing in California during this drought. Right now, we're speaking with Catherine Mizkowski, a senior reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. We're also joined by Lance Williams, a senior reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting, also writing for Reveal. And both of our guests write for numerous awards and write for numerous publications. The stories we're discussing now have been done over the past year at revealnews.org, so you can learn more at those sites. So, Catherine, let's go back to you. You're writing about how we have this lack of transparency. So what can you tell our listeners about what is happening to challenge or change this? We've certainly heard Governor Brown make some stern warnings and make some changes, right? But some of the criticism has been that he's not leveling it at the correct people or the correct institutions. You get what I'm saying here.
Sure, yeah.
So talk a little bit about this.
Well, I mean, we have not seen a movement yet to try to repeal these changes to the California Public Records Act that we've identified in this article. We're not aware of any member of the legislature who's bringing a bill to do that. And I think another important aspect of this is the law we talked about that was supposed to protect the privacy of residential water customers has since been applied successfully to corporations. So the example is in the Coachella Valley, where there's a lot of golf courses and they're using tremendous amounts of water. The agency had previously published the amount of water used by their top customers, and then they stopped doing that. And a nonprofit organization sued and said, you know, we want to know, like, how much are these golf courses using in this very arid area in the drought? And a judge found that because of this change to the Public Records Act, the agency had no obligation to disclose it. And he said in his decision that the companies do not have the same right to privacy as individuals. However, the law had been written to cover customers, and they were customers. And so here you have this thing that was created to supposedly protect people's privacy that's now, you know, protecting corporations from public scrutiny.
Now, Catherine, that's records from public agencies that are pumping water and then selling it to people. The idea that people could individually put a well in and pump water from the aquifer, and that is what we really don't know. There was some attempt this past year to try to get some handle and regulation on that, and most people are not complying. Is there a will in the state legislature to really try to put coverage on this? Lance?
It was not easy for the legislature to pass any regulation at all of groundwater use. The measure that they did get passed, the people who pushed for it were self-congratulatory that they got anything at all out of a legislature and in an environment where we just haven't done that for 100 years.
So what does that say then about the political culture? What does that also suggest to you, Lance, and then also like to hear from you, Catherine, about this, about the lobbying efforts, about the power of corporations over the political system, and again, the wealth, back to the issue of class and that impact on the political system. This is no joke, the water drought. This affects everybody. Everybody has to drink water. Everybody needs water. So what might it take, you know, in order to sort of break this logjam?
Well, ag is still powerful politically, and agriculture interests are getting cut way back already from their allocations from the state and feds. Water agencies are very powerful in the legislature, too. And so that was the resistance to doing anything at all about groundwater. To get a measure through it all was difficult. The measure doesn't take effect for years and has the other imperfections that we were mentioning. I suppose it's considered a start.
And we should also mention there are these so-called well logs. So the people who are doing the drilling keep some logs and have data, but those are also secret under California law. And there has been an effort politically to change that, but so far that hasn't happened as well. And those logs would help, like, scientists assess the condition of the aquifer and, you know, how much water's in there and so on.
So private farmers for three generations have been able to sink a well and use whatever amounts of water they wanted. And that in some places has caused some shrinking of the land. I mean, in some areas in the southern Central Valley, there's over 30 feet difference than it was 50 years ago. The land's actually elevation is 30 feet lower. And in some places, it's like a foot a year now.
That's right.
So, but yet these farmers, and I kind of grew up in that culture, believe that they own the land, they own the water. They have the use of it. And on surface streams, there's water rights that are historical, where farmers can actually sell water to cities and make money from water that they just happen to have a right to. But the aquifer and the ground, is that public water? I mean, does that really belong to all human beings or in the state, water shared, or does that belong to the landholders?
Well, farming's a business, and those guys have conducted their business for generations. being able to tap the groundwater when they don't have enough irrigation water. So that's the resistance point there.
So we're talking right now with Lance Williams, senior reporter at Center for Investigative Reporting, also Catherine Miskowski, senior reporter for Reveal, also at the Center for Investigative Reporting. And you've both been writing about water for some time. So I would like to bring into the mix here some review as far as water issues and the drought go is sort of the elephant in the room. We've had a lot of squabbling, right, about who's to blame and who's using the water. Of course, one of these problems that you're addressing is that we don't always know who's using the water, and now it's shielded. We have this lack of transparency. Meanwhile, we still have the war happening against almonds, right? It's a specific targeted thing against almond farmers. Of course, the meat industry is using far more. That seems to escape some of the scrutiny that we see directed in other areas. Meanwhile, Nestle is bottling water, right, in the state of California. In other words, we don't seem to be targeting the areas where we could make some differences. And what do you think about that, Catherine? What is your research sort of shown about that? And what's your view on maybe why some of this is going on?
Well, I just think we've long had a philosophy that you can use as much water as you can get your hands on and you can pay for. And you even see it in these agencies, these, you know, water districts like East Bay MUD, that when they are under orders from the state to cut back, that, you know, they tell everyone to conserve. They nominally target their biggest users. They say they're now going to impose excessive use penalties on people who are using more than four times the typical customer. But that penalty is $2 for every extra 748 gallons of water you use. So you can imagine if you're a wealthy person is using a ton of water, like $2 is not going to be a very big disincentive. So I think we've just had this mentality that as long as you can pay your bill, you can do pretty much whatever you want with the water that you can get your hands on.
Lance, you on the same issue.
I was just thinking that we have a crisis because of the habits we've accumulated over the years. There are tremendous conservation opportunities in industry and in agriculture that could be imposed. Those aquifers, in most cases, can be recharged. LA's whole urban water system is based in part on putting water underground and bringing it back up. You can do that. But we just haven't done that in the Central Valley, and now we're in a pickle.
So for an individual to be encouraged to take a shorter shower, is that sort of kind of scapegoating the general population? I mean, when really there's these really massive water users out there. Lance, can you comment on that?
Yeah, you feel like a fool if you do that, and then you find out that the city councilman is using enough for eight families to keep his willow tree spiffy. It's just ridiculous, and it demoralizes people or makes them cynical and makes them not want to participate in conservation efforts because it looks like only saps are conserving, and that's the real problem that the agencies ought to think more about.
So if the saps knew who was really using the water, including their own political people in their own cities, then you might see some change. So that's why you're advocating for full disclosure.
Absolutely. I don't want people's home addresses published in the paper or anything like that, but if there's people who are using extreme amounts of water during a drought, and if the water agencies are letting them do it, we ought to be able to know about it.
Yeah, right now we're really not in a position to even evaluate the policies these water districts are imposing and the ways they're trying to conserve. You know, how can we know if these policies are fair or distributed equitably if we don't really know who's using the most water?
Yeah, again, these are very important things to know. The reporting that you're doing on this for the Center for Investigative Reporting is key. The public clearly needs to know about it. Certainly, people can find your work. It's been published, of course. The website is Reveal News.
Revealnews.org.
Right. And where else can people find your work, Lance? At the same website and where else?
You know, a lot of our stuff has been published in California newspapers on their websites as well.
Okay, so the word is getting out. Right, that this is a problem, and I guess part of what I'm at least seeing behind some of this reporting is, and you can say, but is your hope then to raise awareness such that people will pressure the legislature to change this transparency issue?
Yes, we hope wisdom descends like a gentle rain on the lawmakers and that they do the right thing.
Indeed, along with a little bit of real rain.
Sure.
So, Catherine Miskowski, last words, anything you'd like to add today?
Well, I mean, I've just been fascinated to learn how little transparency there is in California on this incredibly important issue for all of us. And so I'm just excited to continue reporting on it.
And so revealnews.org, you can go there and find a lot of these stories. And I'm imagining that you are working on some other water stories now. Are you working on something?
Definitely. We have a few things coming up.
All right. And so people can find that at revealnews.org. Lance, same?
Absolutely. You know, you have to fight for every scrap of information about water use in California, but we'll keep fighting.
Okay. Well, we're very happy to have you both, Catherine Miskowski and Lance Williams, on the Project Censored Show, working for the Center for Investigative Reporting. And again, thank you very much for joining us and talking about this very important issue.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, we're going to hear a San Francisco Bay Area spoken word artist, former student at Sonoma State University. Nick George graduated in 2011. Is going to continue with a theme of water issues. Nick, you're up.
All right. Thank you very much. This is Nick George. I also go by Oso Cali, O-S-O-C-A-L-I. This spoken word piece is called Water. Let me touch on a problem that is basic. Is there really any escape in these money-hungry corporations looking to take over and continue water privatization, promoting the hunger of many through mass starvation? It's been going on for years all over these third world nations, trying to delete them out of their equation. Don't get it twisted, it's been happening here too. You just might have missed it. Aquafina, Arrowhead, Nestle, just to name a few. Bottles on bottles, only so much a Brita filter can do. Now they're contaminating our sources and water's no longer blue. People keep on wasting without even having a clue. They'll hear this and say, nah, that can't be true. Well, I hate to sound cliche, and you don't even know why, but we'll miss that water when these wells run dry. Depleting all our aquifers, not giving sufficient time to replenish themselves, turning our world into a desert earth, not concerned about the next child's birth. What's going to happen when we start to die from thirst? Speaking on this subject, best believe I'm not the first, and I'm not going to be the last. We got wars over oil, and those won't be our last. Water makes oil look like nothing. Without it, we won't last. It's just a little frightening, the biggest aquifer we have, located in the Amazon. Let me tell you what's going on. The corporate elite and all those evolved understand this world we live in, around water it revolves. So listen to what I'm saying and let your minds evolve, because these global problems we really need to resolve. Because if we don't, we might as well just dissolve back into this dirt, but I'd rather stand tall and fight for what is right. Before we start to fall, we owe it to our children, we must answer this call. What kind of world is this where money has more value than our water? Money stacks are getting taller and glasses are getting smaller. In the end, my only question is, can we drink those dollars?
That's Nick George, San Francisco Bay Area spoken word artist. Thank you very much, Nick.
Yeah, thank you.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we will be talking more about water woes in California. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, the theme is water crisis in California and around the world. We've been speaking with investigative reporters and heard from a spoken word artist on issues surrounding water. And now we turn to a senior Project Censored researcher, a student at San Francisco State University, Stephen Ferrer. He's a geographer and somatic educator, and his research topic this past semester for Project Censored is fracking and water contamination in California. So, in fact, one of the stories that's coming up in Censored 2016 in the top list is the water issue, and specifically we are looking at a massive dumping of wastewater, right, into aquifers, and how big oil has a role in this. We're also looking at California aquifers contaminated with billions of gallons of fracking wastewater. Those were stories on Indie Bay, on Russia Today. There were several other stories that were researched, but Stephen Fair is joining us today to talk with us about his research and about the significance of these stories. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tell us about this research you did, Stephen, at San Francisco State University with our affiliate professor, Ken Burrows.
Yes.
Right? And we've worked with Ken for years. And I know Ken certainly has near and dear to his heart the issues of water and nature and ecology and so on. And so what drew you to these stories and how did you come to find them?
Well, as you know, like water is a critical issue for whether you're California or anyone who uses water, and that's all of us. So I initially was prompted to check out some issues relating to water resources, and it seems like hydrofracking and natural gas production is kind of like a big boom now. A lot of people are talking about how it's going to help our economy and it's saving us and all that kind of business. And there's also a lot of controversial issues around it. So I wanted to look a little bit deeper at it. Going through the geography to program at San Francisco State and looking into issues of water. So I initially found the one on Russia Today and also another investigative report that brought in another element about the groundwater contamination from the injection wells. So that also included a report from the Center for Biological Diversity. So there were two issues going on. One was that the injection wells were within like a 1 mile radius from some kind of in use clean aquifers in Kern County. And the other one was just about half of the 2,500 injection wells were located within 10 miles of active fault lines. So, you know, some of the themes were that it's increasing micro seismic or little earthquakes around the country. And I just wanted to follow up on those.
And so, Stephen, we do know that fracking has been connected to the triggering of earthquakes and places like Oklahoma and places where Ohio and, you know, places where we don't see earthquakes very often. In a place like California, having this phenomenon be as widespread as it is seems dangerous. Would you categorize it that way?
Potentially dangerous. Yeah, of course. One of the elements about injection wells is it just doesn't go down vertically. What people are finding is that those chemicals also kind of migrate horizontally. So if you're injecting it close to a clean water source, how do you monitor it? You know, how do you find out when it's leaking in, how long, when it's done leaking into a place, what's happening to those water sources? So I would say that's an issue of concern, to say the least.
Unfortunately, we're finding out more and more about the fracking chemicals into the water. Mm-hmm. And we've heard the stories about both contaminated water. We saw stories about how members of big industry would say, well, the water is not dangerous. And some people said they would drink it and so on. And when they're presented with it, they
right.
don't drink it. Uh-huh. And again, this gets into things outside of fracking. But let's stick to the issue of water for right now.
Sure.
And fracking. What can you tell us? Again, you mentioned the Center for Biological Diversity. Can you talk to us about any of the MAP Light? MAP Light is Money and Politics Light organization in Berkeley, California. And they track money going into the political system, contributions, right, to politicians. And then they follow up on, well, what bills do those politicians introduce? Which ones do they vote for? And they show a correlation between money and politics, right?
Sure.
And I teach a course on money, power, and politics. And
okay.
MapLight kind of really is shining a light on this issue. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about some of the findings you had in terms of the financing going in and how it is affecting the political climate?
The research that I looked at, what I noticed was more about the government agencies that help patrol some of these things. So, for instance, it's not just the EPA that's kind of tasked with tracking these things, but the EPA actually granted the California Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources to do a lot of the monitoring. Like I said, the research that I had didn't list specifically how much money or what percentage of corporate funding is going into these government agencies.
Well, oil, of course, is a huge lobby in California, spending over, again, these figures are coming from MapLight, $63 million in efforts to persuade policymakers to allow the expansion of fracking. And again, you know, this led to the rejection of a fracking moratorium bill, mm-hmm. right? So we see that there was a movement to try to limit the amount of fracking. Mm-hmm. That went down, right, in defeat. And the reason that I had asked that is the figure is somewhat startling here. And again, if you look at the map light figures, senators that voted no on the moratorium bill received an average of about $25,000 from the oil and gas industry versus those that voted yes who received less than $2,000 on average. I mean, again, this isn't just incidental,
right?
This is showing that there is a serious issue. Mm-hmm. And again, the theme here earlier when we were speaking with the investigative reporters was political will.
Yeah.
And lack of transparency.
Right.
Well,
right.
At least MapLight is showing us some transparency, mm-hmm. but they're also showing the lack of political will up close.
Sure. And I guess some of the issues that some of my research was kind of highlighting is just the there isn't a straight shot for, you know, I check the water, I make sure this is done. And these agencies are all kind of either talking to each other or not talking to each other, or to what degree they're kind of they let certain things slide, maybe because somebody is promoting. They're saying, hey, look, we're really working towards this goal. Well, you know, we're making money at this, so why don't you just hold off on some of the levels of inspections that you're able to do. And in some cases, there are certain agencies that aren't able to actually do the kind of quality research that we need.
So, Stephen Fair, what did you get out of doing this research with Ken Burrows at San Francisco State University? And, of course, we're going to have these stories also worked with, by the way, on these water stories that are going to be in Censored 2016. We also have Susan Rahman of College of Marin and Carolina de Mello, who is her student researching mm-hmm. these stories. So there's a collection of water stories. So what did you get out of this, and what do you hope is going to happen if we can get some more attention to these important stories?
Well, I guess what I got out of it was to be able to, you know, part of Project Censored is media literacy. And I feel like that I was able to take the opportunity to learn a lot more about how these pieces fit together. Sometimes you get one story that's telling you a very clear bullet pointed statement that may not be very accurate or is trying to sway me in one direction or another. And some of these issues can be really daunting, especially if you want to be engaged and you want to move, you know, take your vital, precious resources, your own personal resources, and really invest in something that makes a difference towards a benefit to others and yourself. So, you know, I think that that's what it was, a really good opportunity for me to be able to take a closer look at those things.
Stephen Fair, thanks so much for your work and for your research helping mm-hmm. out here at Project Censored and really helping raise awareness about these key issues. It's greatly appreciated, and thanks for taking the time to come in today and talk with us.
No, you're welcome. It was a passion and a pleasure.
I'd like to thank Dr. Andy Lee Roth, our associate director at Project Censored, for helping compile some of the information about these water stories. After this break, we'll be back and speak with author Kirk Hyland. His book is If Earth Could Speak. We'll be talking to him about the importance of building and expanding the technology for water desalinization. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's theme is water, and certainly the water crisis and drought in California. And our next guest is Kirk Hyland. He's author of a book, If Earth Could Speak. He's going to talk about the importance of building and expanding the technology for water desalination. And it reminded me of an old Samuel Taylor Coleridge poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. One of the lines in the poem is, "Water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink." Well, if Kirk Hyland has his way, that would not be a dilemma, right? So here is Peter Phillips, and we're going to now talk with author Kirk Hyland. His book is If Earth Could Speak. Peter?
Kirk Hyland, thank you so much for joining us. The book is entitled If Earth Could Speak. I can't not ask you, what would Earth say?
I think Earth would say, what are you doing? I mean, I gave you a perfectly stunning, gorgeous home in between the arms of the Milky Way galaxy, protected from the radiation from the center of the black hole of the galaxy, so you're protected in a cradle and you've been given this gift of life, and instead you run a casino game until you're gone.
Okay, that's quite amazing. Your book is about desalinization and how that could really have a major impact on the world. Talk about that, and what is your vision here?
This book was written as basically a citizen of the planet taking responsibility. In the corporate technology field that I've worked in for 35 years, you stand in the future and you work on systems that can never go down. So I looked at the system known as human civilization and came up with a plan that would prevent it from going down. The four factors are human behavior, the extension of which is political and economic systems, and one thing that is now in play for the first time in history, which sets a precedent for uncharted territory, is the environment is now in play. It is in play with an ever-expanding population base with a net population growth of 20,000 persons every 90 minutes and an exponentially diminishing freshwater source. But we do not have a shortage of water. We only have a shortage of freshwater impending with aquifers. And as we talked about, and the Caspian Sea is one-third gone. What's your exit strategy? The Aral Sea was the fourth largest inland body of water. It is already gone. So with no exit strategy, with no business plan for the planet, we don't have one. And so I took it upon myself to write one.
So, Kirk, you in your book, you're talking about desalination, and you're obviously focusing on solutions, right, to these problems. And you just said, we don't have a shortage of water, right? What we seem to have maybe is a lack of converting the types of water that we do have access to into water we can use. There are numerous places around the world where desalination plants are operating, right? And, of course, we have some in the United States. There are several in Spain, around Europe, and so forth. But let's talk a little bit about the hurdles. What's standing in the way of developing these desalination plants? In other words, University of California, Santa Barbara, and other institutions have obviously been looking at this issue, and they have pros and cons lists, right, about, well, what's good about it? Well, we know what's good about it, but what's bad about it? So in other words, let's hear from your perspective. How do you handle some of the con arguments about desalination?
That's right in my wheelhouse. The cons are usually that the technology is poor and it's expensive. The technology is, in fact, poor at this point. So what you have to understand is that conceptually you're building out what the Roman Empire did with their aqueduct system, and we get to work now with standard technologies, with using architects and engineers to build out a distribution system so that when the technology is good, when the technology is available, and maybe that's within our generation, maybe it's two generations from now, that the infrastructure to distribute that water will already be built. So in essence, you're reverse engineering what the Romans did. Now, do we need all the current desal technologies that are on the table right now? Yes, we're going to need every single one of those bridge technologies until we can get to the technology of the future with respect to desalination. But that is our only option to do this. Now, let's talk about the economic factor. People say it's too expensive. So that begs the question, do you want the survival of business? Or do you want to focus on the business of survival? So we are biological carbon-based beings. That's real. We exist. Money does not exist. It's a contrived mechanism. Political systems are contrived mechanisms. The monies that we're talking about in terms of the actual expense are also contrived because just as a signpost, prior to the 2009 banking crisis collapse, money had a different value. Human life and survival is the only value. But let me just give you a prime example of how we implement this. In 1960, President John F. Kennedy said, "We're going to the moon." We didn't have the technology yet. Now, he said we were going to do it in 10 years. We did it in just under 9. Two things that are important for you to note. The lunar lander was the key technology. They worked on that really hard right up to the end. But what they did do is that they started working on the infrastructure of the aqueduct system that we're talking about that will distribute the desalinated water. They built out the Saturn V delivery system, which was the infrastructure to get that lunar rocket there. So in the same vein, we need to start on a global works project as one civilization.
Kirk, you're talking about a Manhattan-style project or a lunar landing project with extensive amounts of money spent to not only build an infrastructure of water delivery worldwide, but then to expand and develop technology for desalinization so we can use the water from the ocean. And from your book, I read that you would like to see the Mojave Desert turned into a blooming garden of food growing, or the Sahara and other places in the world, certainly Africa and elsewhere, and that this would, in fact, deal a whole lot with global warming and water issues and famine. I mean, it would make unlimited food supplies available. I saw this as a very wonderful, vision of where we can go. How do we get there? And what's the technology needs that we have to have?
Well, first of all, we can turn planet Earth into the largest CO2 processing mechanism in the solar system. And we do that by building out the viaduct system for the desalinated water from the technology that we have yet to acquire. And when we turn the switch on and start irrigating the earth, we will then, in fact, be able to bring more plant life, which does the photosynthetic process, which happens to love carbon dioxide, and we can naturally cleanse the earth. The earth becomes the single most efficient CO2 cleansing mechanism in our solar system. Now, going back to the money issue, the unpublished chapter, since you read the book, Peter, you'll note that I made a note in the back about the unpublished chapter. I already know how to pay for all this. In fact, money being a contrived mechanism, I figured that out, but it is not in the book. It is the unpublished chapter because we need to get a change of mind first. We have to agree to all pull on the same rope.
We're speaking with Kirk Hyland, author of the book If Earth Could Speak. We're talking about the possibilities of how to resolve the water crisis or water drought. And Kirk Hyland is saying that we don't have technically a water shortage, but we have maybe a paucity of imagination or political will in order to maybe look at things like desalination as a solution to these problems. And I'd like to go back to the issue of, again, some of the challenges, because we have Santa Barbara, we have Carlsbad, there's desalination in Tampa Bay in the United States, and it certainly has gotten attention in the last couple of years, right, as a, hey, why can't we do this? And of course, one of the issues was that it's expensive, and you're talking a little bit about, well, there's ways around this, right? The other, however, I mean, even if we use, again, the other idea was the big carbon footprint for the energy required to do the desalination process. However, we could use renewable energy for that, right? So, and that's, of course, a major, you bring that up, and that's, of course, been put out there for public consideration. But there's one other issue, and perhaps you could address this for our listeners, is that there are byproducts as a result of desalination, and a lot of the focus has been, what do we do with these byproducts? And they're too much salt in the water is harmful to sea life. Again, so this is another hurdle that's been thrown up. How do you address that challenge in your book, If Earth Could Speak, Kirk Hyland?
If Earth Could Speak proposes a all-encompassing solution for the planet. And so, yes, the byproduct of desal, current technologies of desal, are brine and subsequently salt within the brine. Now, what could you do with all that? Now, without giving away the entire book, salt is the world's best insulator. And we have a problem with global warming with concrete radiating heat into the atmosphere. Now, if some brilliant chemist or nanochemist could reformat the dissolution and corrosive properties of salt, we could start using it on our roads, which would be easier on the cars. We could start building our buildings with it, which and no longer radiating heat, but be better insulated for cold and heat. But on top of that, the brine itself, maybe through renewable technologies, solar, yes, thank you, could in fact be extracted from the salt. Maybe brine becomes a fertilizer like they did in the old days. They would use fish as fertilizer. Maybe the brine becomes the natural fertilizer without the salt, because we already have a problem with soil salinity that we've never solved since the days of the Sumerians. So I think it's high time we addressed soil salinity. And the byproducts, some of the best inventions have always come out of what can I do with the leftovers?
We're speaking with author Kirk Hyland. The book is If Earth Could Speak. We're talking specifically right now about some of the water challenges we face and possible solutions. One of these that Kirk Hyland addresses is desalination. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're continuing our discussion with Kirk Hyland, author of the book If Earth Could Speak. Again, the theme of today's show is water. And right now in this segment, we're talking about how we can face some of these challenges. Peter?
Kirk, earlier in our show today, we had investigative reporters on that talked about who was using the water in California specifically. But you have some perspective on that. Tell us what you think.
I do. There's some pet projects that don't hit the airwaves that are using some water, and you'll be a little bit abhorred to hear about this, but one of the projects that's most glaring, the Kern River Oil Field Project. They're using water to create steam to pull the last vestiges of those oil wells that were dormant, in essence, to try and get the last bit that they can get out of that oil field. So while we make almond trees and blueberries the victims of this entire water crisis, can you tell me how somebody is allocated the money for extracting oil from a field for oil that we don't actually have a shortage of? So we don't need that.
Well, Kirk, it's also the case, and this came up earlier, you know, mentioned Nestle bottling water and shipping it out of the state, you know, obviously kind of like it's just going, right, it's just coming out of the ground. They're just taking it, they're selling it, they're profiting from it. We mentioned earlier also in a segment about the problems of wastewater and fracking. And again, earlier in the program, too, we mentioned the scapegoating of certain products, right, that use a lot of water, whether it's almonds, certainly the meat industry using even more. So that kind of is another one of those elephants in the room that seems to escape. It seems like the larger the corporation or the more money they have, the more influence they have over the political system to sort of shield or hide their usage. And we even brought that up, right, earlier in the program. So what you're talking about here is, I think what you're saying is that there's a solution here. And it's us. And so tell us about that. What's your vision of this solution?
But before I get to that, I just want to identify the other usage, which is the Geyser's geothermal plant in Geyserville, California, is a voracious animal. You're stuffing water into a heated cistern to power San Francisco. What if you took all that money and gave all the people of San Francisco, through an easy buy program, solar collectors? You wouldn't need the geothermal system, and therefore that water goes to the people that are in their homes. And you can't tell us we have a shortage when these pet projects are using untold amounts of water.
So how do we then make that happen? The book here is If Earth Could Speak, and you have a lot of these ideas here. So tell us, in your mind, what is the solution? How do we bring about these changes?
If Earth Could Speak is a change in mindset. And I'm not the type of person that looks at the past. The past is gone. It doesn't serve us at all anymore. So if you're only looking forward and you're talking about evolution versus revolution, we're talking about a bloodless evolution where we human beings turn into, for once, turn into sophisticated beings instead of the global barbaric warring factions that to this date we still are. Now, those are primed by the premise of profiteering. And profiteering and power, they go hand in hand, and that creates the political systems. But if we want to get out of this mess, since no political system has ever stood the time in the history of time, they've all been turned over. And every time they turn over, they don't come up with a new political system that's different. So what I'm saying is we design the political system of the future, And that isn't necessarily fed by profiteering, because profiteering and survival are discrete items by definition. Capitalism and democracy are two separate words in the dictionary, and through clever marketing, both from the corporate world and the political world, we've been led to believe that they're actually the same thing, but they are not.
Kirk, as I read your book, I saw this vision of a world full of water, the vast areas that aren't productive land in terms of growing agriculture could be, that a Manhattan-style project to create desalinization, bringing fresh water to Nevada and Utah and many, many other areas around the world that are dry, would not only create massive employment, greater equality. And you have a part in here called "It's Time for Benevolent Business Has Arrived." Do we need an Occupy movement of building consciousness for water for all?
Well, I think Occupy and Arab Spring were the same message, which was when financial exploitation becomes so severe, you get to a breaking point. And so what I'm saying in the book is that every economic system, and this simulation is running to perfection, we're watching the acceleration of the accumulation and the consolidation of wealth right before our eyes. At the end of the simulation, there's only one company. So instead of allowing our economic systems, our social systems, and our political systems to have an expiration date, and that's when bloodshed occurs, we design that for the future, and we can do that with an aggressive desal Roman Empire style, but no invading military army, an army of people that want to do this for the next seven generations, set the table for success. The earth has 100,000 year cycles. 90,000 of them are cold, very cold, all in the northern hemisphere. Don't you think we ought to prepare for that? If you took the Sahara, which has 15,000 year cycles, it becomes a very verdant, lush environment, and then it turns to desert. We don't have another 6,000 years to wait for it to come back to be lush and verdant. I'm saying we reclaim the Sahara Desert, but the only way you can do that and build out the infrastructure for the next ice age, which is definitely coming, because every mud core and ice core that's ever been pulled out says in the 100,000-year cycle, only 10,000 of them are warm. We're at year 12,800. And what people think is that ice ages occur in 10, 20, 50, 100 years. The last one happened because global warming is the precursor to global cooling. The last one occurred 800 years ago. It was known as the Big Freeze, and it happened in 6 months. So literally, people in Northern Europe, Northern Asia, the United States, Japan, Korea are going to be running for their lives. But if you take this plan, you can then architect your future, and you can then take those populations and move them to the Sahara. But you only do that by developing the next generation economic system where you're not screwing your neighbor through currency arbitrage and everything else that goes with it.
So, Kirk Hyland, where can people learn more about your book, maybe a website perhaps, If Earth Could Speak?
The website is called ifearthcouldspeak.org, and it's been an absolute honor to be invited to be here today.
Kirk Hyland, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
We want a liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that concludes the Project Censored show today for Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our producer Anthony Fest and our engineer Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored show airs on 25 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. Almighty.